concrete and steel. That's what we see when we look up at city skylines. But what if those empty rooftops could feed the very communities living beneath them? While most of us see wasted space, Orlane and her business partner, Alexandre, saw opportunity. A network of microfarms that could transform urban food systems one rooftop at a time. They didn't chase venture capital. They didn't build massive indoor operations. Instead, they created something more nimble, an amenity service that turns unused urban spaces into thriving farms maintained by experts, benefiting everyone from office workers to food banks.
We offer an amenity service that focuses only on outdoor food production. We don't do ornamental plants, we just focus on the food aspect. And so that's really where we created that new space and developed our offer.
In this episode, I sit down with Orlane Penney, the co-founder of Microhabitat, to unpack how they built over 400 farms across 14 cities by thinking small to scale big. From convincing skeptical building owners to creating a new category of green infrastructure, this is a story about seeing possibility where others see emptiness.
We're now a team of over 50 people during the growing season, so I have an expansion team and procurement team that supports those team. COVID was great for that. You know, we were growing at 2 to 3 times each year.
Welcome to The Capitalist Hippie, the podcast where we challenge the old rules of business to build something better. I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert, entrepreneur, and lover of bold, sustainable ideas. Every week, we dive into data-backed insights, groundbreaking ideas, and real-world strategies that help you outthink and outmaneuver the status quo.
Seeing all those unused spaces in urban settings, roofs, ground spaces, there's so much potential.
What began with just 2 clients, a residential property, and a high-end restaurant has evolved into a movement that's redefining how cities feed themselves, and they're just getting started. Let's dig in. Orlane, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I'm excited to dive into this topic today because you've taken essentially underused rooftops and you've turned this into like a flourishing urban farm that feeds cities, it fuels, you know, climate storytelling and action, and community food. So like it's all these amazing things, but how you've done this is really interesting. What was the core, like what was the first idea? Like what was the, like what was that kind of first spark or idea? Like we're going to change the way that we do urban farming.
Yeah. Well, I have to really give the credit to my business partner, Alexandre. He was finishing his studies in environmental sciences and agriculture. So he had the, you know, the background to be able to develop the business model. And I think it really bloomed from the idea of seeing all those unused spaces in urban settings, roofs, ground spaces. There's so much potential. And so he thought about the idea of the microhabitat model, which is transforming unused spaces, integrate urban farming and build urban resiliency through urban farming. So that's how it started. And I joined him. I felt the idea was really great. My background is in accounting and management, but I always had that, you know, interest in developing something that would be good for sustainability, be conscious about climate changes. And we were friends since high school. And so when he told me about the idea, I wanted to jump in right away. So that's how it started.
Yeah. And it was in 2014 that you launched?
Yeah, officially in 2016, but we started working on it 2 years prior to that.
Yeah, so what was that, I guess, that initial business model that was a bit different than maybe the way that these unused roofs were being used before, or maybe some of the, because even, you know, almost 10 years ago now, there probably wasn't that many urban farms on empty roofs, I'm going to guess.
Yeah, it still is. It's still not super developed. I think 2 models that we've seen that were out there were the traditional landscaping company that was, you know, that's offering a landscaping that's normally ornamental and not edible. Some will add sometimes a little bit of edible production, but it's not specialized on agriculture. And the other avenues we saw being developed is more indoor farming, vertical farming, where companies are taking vacant spaces, turning them into indoor farming facilities, and then producing with a model that sells fresh produce. So we're really at the middle point of that with Microhabitat because we offer an amenity service that focuses only on outdoor For the moment, we have an indoor solution that's coming out, but that's focusing on food production. No, we don't do ornamental plants. We just focus on the food aspect. And so that's really where we created that new space and develop our offer.
And when you first had this idea to do this and kind of go out there, was the initial thing, let's test this with a partner? Or did you end up saying, can we like lease a roof? Like, how did you take that first step?
Yeah. So the model was always built to be an amenity service. So thinking of having a client that pays for the service, just like you would do for your landscaping company, and then making sure that our experts in urban farming would do everything for the client.
This is a brilliant business model shift. Instead of competing in the crowded produce market, Microhabitat created an entirely new category, urban farming as a service. It's not about selling tomatoes, it's about selling the infrastructure, the expertise, and experience of hyper-local food production.
Alex, when he started the business, was able to confirm two projects, so one with a residential property at an architect's home, and then a high-end restaurant, which is in Antonio Park, a very high-end restaurant, a sushi restaurant here in Montreal. And so it made sense for those end users to have a production on site, have that farm-to-table concept. And so that's really how it started. But when I joined in the company, I quickly realized that there was a lot of potential that was going much further than hospitality and residential. We understood that commercial real estate could benefit from this, and started to develop that for all the different types of asset classes. So that's how we expanded from those two clients to developing now the world's largest urban farming network.
Yeah, we could dive into that even a little bit further. So like, I think people would probably initially think that to build out urban farms kind of across North America as you're currently doing right now. I think you have over 400 farms.
Correct.
Yeah. It's a big number that you would naturally just start to be like, we're going to lease, we're going to produce a bunch of food. The benefit is that we're using underused spaces, and then we're going to sell that food. But your model takes a different approach around that amenities side. And you become kind of this expert at being able to deliver an urban farm on a roof and create this kind of flywheel of effect across all of the different stakeholders. How did that kind of model get received when you started out? And what were the kind of immediate benefits that you realized, like, okay, oh, this actually scales a lot better than us kind of doing all that?
I think for us, really, the main interest was seeing all of those unused spaces and knowing that building urban resiliency needs to go through adding back natural spaces, natural environment and infrastructure to make sure that cities are going to adapt, are going to be building a local food system. We've done quite a big research on what were the models. And I think for us, really the intention and hence the name of the company, Microhabitat, is the scalability of the initiative that we wanted to push. Indoor farming requires lots of square footage to be able to do, not to have break evens or even to generate profit. And we just realized that, well, it's not applicable to outdoor spaces. It's not going to be a benefit for biodiversity and local insects. Like it's something that's important. And I think that there's a field that needs to be developed in that sense. But the ecological mission and values that we wanted to bring with the business model were not checked off if we were to consider indoor spaces. And so that's really where we understood that creating micro pockets, micro habitats, small scale farming on multiple locations, decreasing also the capital that's required to be able to exploit and deploy those programs, would make it not just a niche. It would make it available to a lot more people. And I think that's that kind of scale that we already had in mind in thinking, how can we create a global movement with a local presence in every kind of square of space that's available? So that's really what was the main driver of why we decided to do that. And knowing that the mission of what we wanted to do is also create environments that are going to be helping the urban environment in terms of air quality, biodiversity, rainwater management, and heat waves. So climate impacts that our solution is helping and solving.
Yeah, and not to mention just using you know, a space that's underutilized, and building and creating your own localized food chain, which we need more, so that they're not, you know, bringing in other foods elsewhere. When you first brought this kind of to market, was there skepticism around it? Like, was it that the customers were like, well, we could just do this ourselves? Like, what was the main kind of pushback when you started to build this out?
Well, for sure, that point of people thinking that they can do it themselves is one, but it's quickly, you know, it's a conversation that can be quickly turned off, in the sense that a landscaping company is not necessarily specialized in food production. You know, it's two different aspects, even though it looks very closely related. I think the main aspect is starting 10 years ago, I was 23, starting to talk with big building owners and going up to the roof. And I think that was the main, like, whoa factor, like, hey, we're not going to put tomatoes on the roof. And I, after, you know, conversation and practicing the pitch and just like listening to reputations, I was able to really understand where their pain points were coming, where their why they were fearing this kind of action, and being able to come up with whatever answers that needed to happen for this to take place. But for sure, I think change management is always, it takes time. It takes a lot of resources in terms of making sure that people understand why this is possible and what's going to be the benefit of it. But now people fully understand it. And I think the movement of, you know, local agriculture has been pushed a lot more, so people do understand the importance of it. And so it's I feel we're heading into the right direction.
Yeah. And how does the business model work from a customer standpoint? So if a building owner or a restaurant that has unused space, they kind of said, we just have this, you know, we have this big space here, this roof. How do they engage with you? And like, what do you do and what do they do to kind of get a farm on a roof?
Yeah. So we work with property owners, property managers, and also the occupants. Most of our clients are big property ownership group that have global portfolios of all the different types of asset classes, residential, retail, office, and industrial. Basically, whatever the scale of the property, we have an initial virtual conversation with the client. We understand what kind of building they have or buildings, and then we can offer them a free sites assessment. So we have technologies to be able to assess portfolio-wide, or to have a portfolio-wide assessment and identify on the property where exactly could the urban farm could take place. The beauty of what we do is that we only need 250 square feet of space to start. So most commercial building will be able to have that. We're not just looking at the roof. It could be a terrace. It could be a ground level. Most of our retail and industrial buildings will have a space on the ground. And we basically offer a turnkey service. We take care of everything. So we have local farmers that are doing the setup of the farm in about half a day, one day. From that point on, the client has a weekly schedule.
This is what makes the model work. They've eliminated every barrier to entry. No expertise needed, no maintenance headaches, no logistical challenges. By packing urban farming into a frictionless service, they've transformed what would be a complex sustainability project into a simple purchasing decision. That's how you scale impact, by making the right choice the easy choice.
Well, no, every Tuesday, for example, the farmer is going to be on site doing the maintenance and the harvesting, and each building gets to decide what they want to do with the harvest. They own 100% of the production, so 50% of our clients are using it internally. Either you're at the office, you have a harvest stand, you can just pick a share of the harvest, bring that for your lunch or back home. Some will have cafeteria or retailer that can use the fresh produce to prepare meals. Or 50% of our clients are dedicating their harvest to a program for local food banks. So we find the food bank in proximity, we ensure the logistic and providing marketing tool, a year-end reporting, and activations. Because this is really what we want to do in promoting urban farming, is being able to engage the community, let them know about the tangible, sustainable action. People can finally taste it, so why not have them engage in that? Tell them how they can do similar things at home, but also give a perspective of how can we build a more local food system that's going to be more resilient. If you like that homegrown tomato that we have that's purple or striped, or that funky, you know, produce that you can't find at a regular grocery store, why don't you go at your farmer's market? Why don't you support local agriculture that are that are, you know, the players that are also promoting these kind of ways of producing. So it's creating a platform that engages and create a value add for living and working environments.
Yeah, it's super smart, because I can imagine that, like you said, there's varied objectives from all the different companies, but just tackling it is probably where it's hard, right? Like, how do you bring soil on the roof, and how do you maintain it, and how do you do all of those things to be able to package that up? And then obviously your expertise and your ability as you scale from city to city to city brings different perspectives, different benefits to all the companies kind of across this kind of flywheel effect. How did you kind of begin on that initial growth? Was this just through money that you had saved? Was this through some venture or grants, or how did you begin?
We're really lucky. Alexandre and I are still the two only owners of Microhabitat. For sure, there's some programs from Agriculture Canada that support us, or expert programs that helped us in growing. But I think we wanted to be lean in our growth, and being able to grow organically with our clients, leveraging the network of clients and just promoters we had around us, and see how we could grow. And so started off during COVID, where just before COVID hit, we had the plan, we were opening Toronto, their first city. And then from that point on, it was just a trickle effect. So we've opened New York and Vancouver the following season at the same time. And now we're at 14 cities across North America and covering Europe as well. So it's just step by step, leveraging connections and just trying to use our resources as efficiently as possible. And as we know, this is a global movement. People want to know where the food that they consume is coming from. They want to make sure that they're consuming locally, supporting the local economy, and bringing that new green field, green economy, from people working and having opportunities to be doing farming in the city, and supporting the whole network that's around it. So yeah, that's how we did it.
And from the kind of customer perspective, how did you start to build up kind of demand? Was this just, kind of cold calling from office to office and restaurant to restaurant? Like, how did you get to build that an early momentum?
Yeah, well, lots of work. So any kind of way we could find to connect with people, it'd be calling, events, reaching out from different avenues. For sure, when we're talking to property owners, I'm working with banking institution, pension fund, insurance company. Those are the main players. But we have also a few restaurants here and there. But I think it's just seeing, okay, where do we bring value? What's going to be the pitch? What's going to be the perspective? What avenues do we have to be able to connect with those? And just, I think what we're trying to do and what we're bringing is resonating with so many people, that we had the privilege and the luck to have people that were evangelists just saying, hey, I can't necessarily do something for you, but let me put you in contact. It's a lot of legwork. It requires a lot of efforts and resources, definitely still now, but just being able to promote this. And now that's the reason why my role has also shifted into thought leadership, is being able to present to municipalities, governmental bodies, and at conferences to say, hey, they've done it. Like, you can model this and do the same thing.
Yeah. And from your team, how have you built that team, and what does it look like? Because you had mentioned that you work with a lot of different kind of local farmers in the cities that you're in. Are they employees? Are they partners in all the different cities? And how do you scale that? Because that seems very difficult as you kind of scale across all the different cities.
Yeah, well, it's a team effort, but everyone's is an employee from Microhabitat. So whenever we have a new region that's open, we have local infrastructure, local teams that are trained under the Microhabitat standard. We're now a team of over 50 people during the growing season. So I have an expansion team and procurement team that supports those team, and that are able to train them under the standard that we've created. COVID was great for that. We had a bit of a, we were growing at 2 to 3 times each year. So it was a bit of, intense. And COVID, we were able to stabilize our revenue, but it also allowed us to create that space where we looked at our foundation, really started to build this business with an intention of bringing it globally. And that has been really a perfect timing and a great way to make sure that the scalability of the business would work, and we would have the processes to do so.
So when you go to a new city, because you're hiring people to work with you and work for your team, is there a certain number of buildings that you need to have kind of on board to kind of do that? Or is it like, let's get the first one and the first one will get us kind of the next one and the next one?
It always depends on the partner, but we'd like to start with 5 properties per region. Sometimes we have, you know, major partners that are already working with us that are requesting for it to happen. That's what we've done, for example, when we've opened LA, started in 1 year with one project. Following year, we did 10 times, you know, our revenue. So sometimes it's just, you know, having a foot in the door and having people talk about it. And just from there, we're able to grow. So it's a bet to take, but it pays off.
2 to 3 times growth in a year is pretty incredible and impressive. Yourself and your co-founder own 100% of it. Has there been temptation to be like, we want to be in 4,000 cities. Let's take a bunch of venture to do that and really start scaling? Because you've been doing this for over 10 years. So the company obviously has an understanding and a maturity, and the market seems to be aligned with it. How do you think about that?
It's always there. There's always a possibility. I think we just want to make sure that it's going to be a strategic alliance. So having a partner that can open doors, that can understand the long-term vision, I think we want to stay away from just generating revenue for fun that's going to come out of it or that's not going to bring any value.
This patient capital approach is rare and powerful. By maintaining ownership, they preserve the freedom to optimize for impact alongside profit. They're not racing against artificial timelines or growth targets. This isn't just about control, it's about alignment. When your mission requires changing behavior and systems, the traditional venture timeline often forces compromises that undermine your core value.
We see Microhabitat as becoming a powerhouse in terms of sustainability and urban farming in the next 10 years. So we really want to make sure that that's going to make sense. And those new avenue of revenues that we'll want to generate are going to be something that future partners would support. Definitely being 10 years and just us leading this, we want to have that agility, be able to keep that kind of momentum and that kind of speed. And so definitely we want to continue to grow our network, and we're always open to collaboration, to potential partnerships. So it's something we want to explore.
Yeah. How do you do the marketing side or the storytelling side? Because that seems like an important piece. Like, obviously there's community engagement. There's a tangible benefit for what you're doing for your customers, as in, like, there's greenery on the roof, there's food to be either, you know, to be eaten. So like, you literally, your hands are in the dirt and you can feel it and see it. So that's beautiful, because you can see that life kind of growing. How do you help your customers take that? And because I think there is a piece of that, right? Like, you engage community because community gets to see this. And that's hard. That is hard to do. Like, I think a lot of people struggle to storytell. And it seems like that's a piece that you help your customers do as well.
Yeah. We've always been investing in creating storytelling, not just for our clients, but also to have people join forces with us and joining our team and, you know, share that passion of why we're doing that. We call our team members change makers, because they're, with their different passion about urban farming, they're able to inspire others. So storytelling is, and it's tough. I mean, there's so much content that's created. So to make our way is always a challenge, but I think being able to, we have that wow factor that I think is a privilege, in a sense that, you know, shooting a video on the 50th floor of a building in Manhattan with the Empire State Building in the background, for sure there is an easy aspect to creating storytelling that's going to be vibrant with that, but it's not everything. I think what is the most challenging part is being able to express values and why above the benefit, the simple benefits that people could see why we're creating this and the movement we're trying to build also.
When you think about the next kind of 3 to 5 years, you're obviously growing into different cities. But there's, I guess, maybe two parts to this question. you are growing into Europe as well. So like there's obviously growth into more cities, which equals kind of more impact, more community involvement, which is a really great thing. But you also mentioned indoors as well, yeah. And that you're working on those two things. So what does the kind of the 3 to 5 years look like? Where do you want to take Microhabitat?
So definitely, as you've mentioned, geographical expansion is what we're trying to do. So Europe and Asia, South America is on our game plan. Then new ways to develop urban farming. So we have this indoor solution that's going to resemble a little bit like an IKEA piece of furniture that you're going to be able to have in your office, at your home, to be able to grow yearly leafy greens. We call it the salad bar. So leafy greens, lettuces, and herbs. For corporate clients, that means also getting the service to make sure that we're continuing to offer that turnkey approach. Defining new avenue of revenue. So we have a new product that's going to be coming soon. Planter boxes, that is basically something that you can also add fencing. We see that a lot of people want to build their own garden, or even our clients, but they want something that's going to be aesthetic, high-end look, but they don't necessarily want to hire a local contractor. They don't necessarily know the technicality of a good system. And so we're trying to build the tools to be able to go B2C with that and really have that as a retail product. And then working on technology. So we have a new platform for clients to access their farm feed, get updates, have access to resources. But this platform is going to evolve into a marketplace, a community building. And we're just trying to create a space where anyone that's growing food can connect to one another and share resources and make sure that this knowledge base is being expanded constantly. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a lot to build. And that's exciting. The consumer side is really interesting because I'm going to guess that when you launch an urban farm, there are materials and ways that you do it that are probably similar on space to space and how you do that. And so is that just the way that, you know, from boxes to, you know, planters to those type of things where you're potentially looking at bringing that to market for consumers to be like, here's, you know, like if you have a 50 square foot place or 100 square foot place, here you go. Here's how you can do it yourself.
100%. Yeah, we've created this specific method that we know works across all climates. For sure, the plants will need to be adapt, but we know that this is the best way to do ecological intensive urban farming on a small scale with minimal investment. And so we already have a setup. We have 4 distribution centers in North America. We have expansion to our procurement team that are already there. So it's like, why not bring the solution to a greater market? And create something that's going to be beneficial for individuals to also benefit from. So yeah, that's the plan.
Yeah, I'm assuming when you're starting off, you must have had some failures in terms of just the farming, like things not growing and things not working and structures. Like how hard was that piece? Because food and nature could be difficult.
Yeah, indeed. I think, well, first, one of the main element and how we've been able to face those challenges is having team members that are really resourceful and knowledgeable about that. We have a lot of people coming from science background, agriculture. So, you know, we've tested this quite a lot and to adapt. The beauty of ecological farming is I will never create a farming zone that has monoculture. The reason why is that it's not beneficial for the environment or biodiversity, but it's also a great way to make sure that we're going to have success. Typical urban farm would have at least 20 varieties. So, and varieties, I mean, you may have 5 different types of tomatoes and then 20 different types of different veggies and herbs. And so if 1 or 2 or even 5 are not making it, then you still have a successful season. And I think it's being open with clients. Listen, even if we've masterized, even if we have over 100 farm in the region, your space is unique. So we're going to try stuff. It's never going to be perfect in the first year. We need to use that season as a way to assess what are the conditions, how is nature evolving in that space, and each season we keep on evolving and optimizing the space, but it's to be transparent.
When I think about a roof, I think about heat and it being hot, and obviously our climate being a bit hotter as well. Obviously, you know, the sun is good for plants as well, but you need water. Is that part of a bit of the tricky part with summer gardens and growing food is just, you know, heat and water and balancing all of that?
Yeah, but what I like to tell people is like ever across the globe, people farm. So there's always ways to do it. I think the most challenging part is more for the farmers. People don't realize, for example, a white roof is going to be reflecting a lot of heat. So it's great for the plants, but for sure, at some point, the farmers need to be well equipped to make sure that they can go through a whole day. And it's just a question of adapting and adjusting based on the farming practices of the region.
The work that you're doing, I don't know, some would probably be like, oh, this must be a nonprofit. You know, the work that you're doing, the impact that you're doing, the community building that you're doing, bringing local food. You chose to build a for-profit, and you know, you talk about this balance between purpose and profit. How was that a difficult decision? Was that a decision in the beginning that maybe we should do this, or was it straight from the beginning, let's do this as a you know, a purposeful for-profit business?
It's definitely something we've looked into for a while. And I think it got to the point where sustainability for us needs to be sustained. And the way to sustain it is by having that structure where we could finance, auto-finance ourselves, create also career opportunities on the long term for people that are joining this movement. So I think those were the main aspect of why we wanted to do that, making sure that we had the means to be able to grow this to a global scale. But I think that the aspect of building a global, a green economy and careers that are going to be very similar to other industries where people can have, growing opportunities and just forecast having a life, a long life, a career in that field. I think that was really at the forefront of why we decided to go for that model, and seems to have been working since then. So.
For people that are listening on the entrepreneur side, or people that are kind of dabbling in, you know, you've spent 10 years of your life building something that is balancing that kind of purpose and profit. And we obviously need a lot more entrepreneurs taking advantage of this. What would you say to somebody that's kind of thinking about jumping into kind of a big idea? You know, yours is a big idea that's been growing quite well. What would you say to that entrepreneur?
I think I've always looked into what we wanted to build with a very logical eye. One of the key elements I bring whenever I have new entrepreneurs that are testing or wondering if their solution is going to be viable is like, go sit down with someone that doesn't believe in your value in whatever your business is bringing, like climate-skeptic people, people not believing that climate changes are real. I had to sit down with them. And if you're able to convince them, and if you're able to have a logical pitch, I think that's a great way for you to then navigate whatever you're going to be facing. It's too easy to be surrounded by people that are thinking alike and that are pushing you, but really you have to be confronted and to set some targets, realistic targets. I mean, it's nice to build a business, but it needs to work. You need to be able to live off of your career. Like you need to make sure that this is going to be viable. Whenever viability is going to come, but to have a game plan and to really be sure that whatever you're setting as objective are going to be maintained, because you have to also sustain yourself. So I think those would
Yeah.
be my two
There's and often a lot of people think about that sustainability or climate itself as the driving force in terms of like customers engaging, and that's often not the case. And it seems like in the case of your business, it's really that you solve actually a pain point for them, and you solve a goal for them that they wanted, but they couldn't figure out how to do that. And it seems like that's kind of the not the trick, but the focus needs to be on what's that value that you're bringing, and then impact will come with that as well.
Yeah, I think it's you always have to think about, what's in it for them. And that, sadly or surprisingly, I don't know, but it's always quite egocentric for a building owner. How can I differentiate my building offering from other office building?
Leading with impact is tempting, but often ineffective. The most successful climate solutions don't win because they're sustainable. They win because they're better solutions to existing problems. Sustainability becomes a strategic advantage, not the primary selling point.
How can I make sure that my office workers are going to be happy and willing to come to work? Or how do they feel like their values are aligned with mine? So it really has to start with understanding the person you have in front of you and trying to understand what are their pain points. And from that point on, then you have a way of connecting with them. I think just pitching whatever you have to offer never makes sense. You have to really fully put your, yourself in people's shoes.
Yeah, and anytime we have somebody that's been doing this for 10 years, I always just also have to just ask, the market has changed in 10 years. Often there was kind of a you have to push the market or push the solution on. And a lot of times now that's kind of changed. Has that demand changed drastically over the last, from 10 years ago to today? Are you seeing a lot more interest?
Yes. Well, for sure. Post-COVID, previous to COVID, it was a bit of a golden age for us. People, real estate was going super well. There was a lot of capital. COVID happened, then it changed the perspective. But now we see that lots of researchers and just major commercial real estate companies are showcasing that what is at the forefront of capital investment is the well-being of the occupant. So this is also good for us. That I think is being able to stay agile and understanding how can I turn a challenge into an opportunity or where can I find new opportunities in my market. It requires creativity sometimes, but definitely I think people in general, there's a global movement for building things for climate changes. And so that's not stopping, even if we feel like some federal governments are slowing down stuff on that. I think individuals in general are still very connected to that mission.
What strikes me most about Orlane's approach is how they balance purpose with pragmatism. They didn't just build farms, they built a business model that makes urban agriculture accessible and scalable. As they expand into Europe and beyond, they're proving that sustainability doesn't have to be sustained by grants or goodwill alone. It can and should be built into the very structures of our cities and economies. Thanks for listening to The Capitalist Hippie. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who's hungry for better solutions in our urban spaces. Until next time.